Welcome to MTG Pro Tutor, your gathering of insights, tips, and advice from renowned players and community icons. Connect with venerated teachers to gain the knowledge you need to improve your skills. Now, here's your planar guide and personal tutor, Sean Penrod.
Welcome back. This is episode 279 of the MTG Pro Tutor Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in today and listening in on these great interviews that we have as we explore sportsmanship, dedication, and respect within the Magic community. I'm Sean Penrod, your host. So happy you are here. Before we dive in, I want to say thank you so much to Paragon City Games for supporting the show, and of course, to you, the listeners, the patrons. Thank you so much for keeping this going. As a thank you, I love to do a giveaway each and every month to all the patrons who are in the Bed of Plants level or higher. Go to mtgpro2.com/Patreon where you can learn more about that and see what that means. And I will, of course, be announcing the winner of last month's giveaway in next week's episode. So stay tuned for that. If you're a patron at the Bed of Plants level or higher, you are automatically entered into the drawing. And stay tuned to hear if you won. And if you are not yet a patron and would like to be, go to mtgpro2.com/Patreon where you can sign up and learn more about that. So this weekend we have two Grand Prix, both in Seattle. And I was going to be in Seattle this weekend for some Navy Reserve training that I had. And I thought that would be cool if I could sneak away and go say hello at the Grand Prix. But last minute, they changed the training from Seattle to San Diego. So I'll be in San Diego this weekend instead of Seattle. So best of luck to everybody who is up there in Seattle playing at both those Grand Prix. I want to revive the call to have listeners turn guests onto the show. We've had one before, and I want to see many, many more. So if you're going to Seattle and you listen to the show, best of luck to you. Run deep, do well, make it to the top eight, and we'll have you on the show. Cannot wait to hear your experience, your story. Speaking of experiences and stories, you should love the interview today as we dive into what it means to be a Magic player. So without further ado, let's start the show. What's up, everybody? I'm super pumped to have our guest with us today. Our guest has been playing Magic since he was 5 and is now a regular of competitive Magic. With some aggressive brewing, he has made a name for himself on the Star City Games circuit. His Pro Tour grind began at Battle for Zendikar with a highlight of a top 8 in Memphis 2018. Come to us from Gulfport, Mississippi. Prodigies near and far. Let's welcome the one, the only, Aaron Barrich. Aaron, how are you doing today?
Doing great.
Excellent. Are you ready to delve into your mind and share with the audience tips and tricks to take the game to the next level?
Always.
Excellent. Now, Prodigies, if you want to connect with Aaron, you can find him on Twitter at RuneClaw_Barrich. That's where you can find him there. And reach out to him, say thanks for being on the show, ask him questions, and that is where you can find him. So, real quick, Aaron, RuneClaw, is that a reference to a card or Magic, or is that does that predate? No, it does not predate Magic because he did Magic at 5 years old. So, where is the name RuneClaw? What's the reference there?
No, that's definitely for Magic. I mean, RuneClaw Bear is just the staple creature now. It used to be Grizzly Bears, but RuneClaw fits much better into the Magic theme.
Love it. Love it. So RuneClaw Bear, got that going on. And as far as outside of Magic goes, are you born and raised in Mississippi? Are you going to school? Are you working? Tell us a little bit of the outside Magic stuff.
Yeah, I am born and raised in Gulfport, Mississippi. Definitely an interesting place for Magic. I kind of don't do a whole lot. I'm at the point in my life, I just turned 21, and I don't exactly know what I want to be doing.
When you grow up. Gotcha. So you have no accent.
No accent. Yeah, I get that a lot.
Yeah. I bet you do. So
I always tell people where I'm from, and they kind of give me a weird look. And like, you don't sound like you should be from Mississippi. And I don't know how to ever respond to that question.
Okay. So, your parents from Mississippi, and like, I mean, you've just been there the whole and just didn't pick it up, or?
Yeah, well, so I live on the coast.
Okay.
And the coast is kind of a touristy area. We have a lot of casinos, and we are definitely the most northern-styled area of the state.
Yeah.
We're a little different than the rest of it.
Cool. I think people, at least in the States, like automatically assume, oh, everybody from the South has an accent. My wife grew up in Tennessee, but both her parents are from like Utah, Idaho. She was born in Utah, but she moved there when she was 4 or something like that. So she doesn't have an accent because she kind of grew up in a house that didn't have an accent. But some people go, oh, you're from Tennessee, you don't have an accent. And that's kind of her story. But you don't have that excuse. You just were born and raised in the South and don't have an accent.
That's simple.
That's cool, man. That's fun. So 21, still trying to figure out what you want to be when you grow up. And right now using Magic to fill the holes, which is pretty cool. And as far as that goes, we mentioned that you hopped into Magic when you're 5 years old. So if you can remember that far, take us back in time and tell us the story. We want to be right there with, you know, 5 year old Aaron, and tell us the very first time you saw or played with Magic cards.
Yeah. So, well, I first started playing Yu-Gi-Oh, right? Which is the gateway game for a lot of people when they were young.
Yeah.
My brother, who is only 7 years older than me, he had some Yu-Gi-Oh cards. So he was 12 at the time. And, I thought they were cool and I liked watching the cartoon. So we started playing Yu-Gi-Oh. Well, one day the Yu-Gi-Oh judge told us to head down to this card store. And, because they ran Yu-Gi-Oh tournaments sometimes. We play in a local mall, just kind of out on tables in the middle of the place. And, when I went to this local store, all I saw was Magic cards. Hmm. Everyone was playing Magic cards. And, everyone was so excited. There was like three different drafts going on. This wasn't a big store. It was a little hole in the wall place. And I just remember looking at this poster, and it was the poster for Butcher Org, I believe. And it was that day was the Scourge release event at the store. And it was just so interesting to see like that style of art, even to little me compared to like Yu-Gi-Oh cards and everything. And it was a bunch of adults playing a game instead of, you know, a bunch of kids. And like every little kid, I wanted to be like the adults and play the cool game that they were playing. Cool. So that's kind of how it was. Me and my dad moved from Yu-Gi-Oh to Magic, and we started playing that together instead.
Cool. So you just mentioned your dad. I was going to say, all right, so we got a 5-year-old you, 12-year-old brother. You guys just waltz on down to the store by yourself. And so your dad was involved with the gaming experience as well?
Yeah, my dad has always been a part of it. He started getting the game because I did. And he saw that he likes strategy games. He's always been like a chess player and like stuff like that.
Yeah.
And he found that interesting in the card game world. So we would play together and we would travel to things together. We would go to FNM every week for many, many years since I was 5. Man. And it's always been our thing, me and my dad.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's really, I feel really special that I got to have something like that with my dad the whole time.
Did your older brother not pick up on Magic?
No, he still does. He still plays. Cool. We have different fathers. So that's like an aspect of that. He would travel with us, but it just like wasn't exactly the same, you know.
Right.
But he still plays a lot. We travel, we play team events together, and it's pretty
fun.
Awesome.
Yeah, that is fun. That is neat to have. Like, we hear a lot that, you know, for many people, the people is kind of the biggest point about Magic that they like and whatnot. And for you, I can tell that is the case, but it's not compounded, but it's enhanced by the fact that those people are your family. That's really cool. That it's really your dad and your brother. And that's really neat that you're able to share that experience with them. So that's really cool. What would you consider is your first set?
I like to consider my first set as, the first set I remember like releasing was Mirrodin. I did play with Mirrodin, at the release of Mirrodin. I went to the store and drafted, and I remember everyone was super excited about like Gilded Lotus, because it had Lotus in the name.
Yeah.
And I was upset because me and my dad, all we got was this stupid card named Chrome Mox, and people seemed way less excited about that one.
Ah, who's laughing now?
Right?
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, so Mirrodin being your first set, what's been your favorite set?
I have to say my favorite set's probably a pretty typical answer. I was a really big fan of Innistrad.
Yeah. What a good set. Classic. So good.
I bet you get that answer probably more than almost any other.
It pops up often, but not often enough that I'm like, oh, I might as well not ask this question anymore. So no, it does. It does pop up, but it was, I mean, for good reason. It's a really good set. Like, I mean, I came back, you know, like many people do have a big old long break. I came back, right before Innistrad, my first draft ever was Scars of Mirrodin. And then, Innistrad was right after that. So I loved that flavor and came in on that. So for me, it's like, oh, my reintroduction to Magic. And so for many people, it was the limited scene and whatnot. So is that why you like it from drafting?
I mean, it was a really cool limited format for me. I think that was about the point in my Magic career. For much of the beginning, you know, when I was little, me and my dad didn't have a huge collection. We'd do a lot of drafts and play a lot of limited because that was just more, it felt like a more level playing field. But around the time in Innistrad, I definitely became more of a constructed player. So that was at the focal point where I was still playing a lot of limited and starting to play a lot more constructed at the competitive level. And it was a really cool set to do that for me. I love those cards. It was very powerful. There was a lot of really cool decks you could do, and there was a lot of room to play with really interesting ideas just because of the way the set was designed.
Yeah. What would you say is one of your favorite cards?
Out of Innistrad?
Or just in general? Just,
just in general?
From Magic.
So I think my favorite, there's two answers I can always give to this. I'm a big fan of Gore Clan Rampager. Okay. It's just the type of card that I love to be playing with. I love aggressive decks. I love modal cards that, you know, Gore Clan Rampager is probably one of the best pump spells you can have in an aggressive deck, as well as just being like always a good top deck. And I have a pretty good history of like that card helping me do fairly well in events. But I think my most favorite designed card is Boonsader.
Ooh.
I am a huge fan of everything that card can do. It's like the ultimate conglomeration of what you want in a deck that it can attack. It's a threat with flash. It's powered well for its mana cost. I mean, a 4/2 for 3 is pretty reasonable. And it has this element to the card that is really hard for people to play around sometimes. You know, Bestow is an interesting mechanic that really didn't get a lot of spotlight when it's time in Standard, but I loved Boonsader. You would be playing these games of Magic, and you could always just attack. Because your opponent, if you just had mana up, your opponent could assume you could just Bestow a Boonsader. And Boonsader was a pump spell plus still a 4/2 after combat. Yeah. And it just ended up being the type of card that I was always happy to have in my decks and always felt like it was leading to really interesting gameplay.
Yeah. Good stuff. Good stuff. Boonsader. Yeah. So, I mean, no one's mentioned either one of those two cards, so you're making history right there. That's cool. So Gore Clan Rampager and Boonsader. Good stuff. What is, for those of us who don't know, like me, Gore Clan Rampager, what does it do and what is it? Why do you like it?
Okay, so Gore Clan Rampager is a really simple card. It's a 2-mana, or it's 4-mana. It's 2 colorless, a green and a red. It's a 4/4. It's from Gatecrash, and it says it's a 4/4 trampler, and you can blood rush it for a red and a green, and target attacking creature gets +4/+4 and trample.
Ah, cool.
Really straightforward card on that one.
Really cool. Yeah, that's good stuff. So you like those creature slash tricks?
Yeah, I mean, I like attacking, yeah, but I don't like boring attacking.
Mm-hmm. So you know, playing Magic since 5 years old, and you know, here you are still playing and doing well. That's awesome. Takes a lot of dedication. So how has your dedication to Magic impacted your life?
A lot. Once you start playing when you're 5 years old, it's something that it becomes natural. Magic is a big part of my life, and it has been forever. And I can't imagine it not being. I spend a lot of my time playing Magic online or playing with my dad or my brother still. And I stream Magic sometimes. And I spend a lot of my time thinking about decks and brewing and traveling. And if I'm not traveling to at least, you know, one Grand Prix or one Open every week, every month, then I feel like I'm doing something wrong.
Hmm. Yeah, it just kind of defined who you are and probably your social groups and, you know, where you find friends and interaction, stuff like that is in the Magic community, I bet.
Yeah, it has. And Magic is a game that is generally played by a more adult audience than other card games.
Yeah.
So when I was young, I was subject to an older audience of people that I got to communicate with and talk with.
Hmm.
And it really helped me grow up much faster. And Magic was a game that helped me a lot through school because it was such a good thinking game, and it helped me think through those types of things. And, you know, I lived in an area that was, I think, kind of interesting in that in Biloxi, Mississippi, right near the card store is Keesler Air Force Base. And so the players that were there changed constantly.
Mm, that's cool.
So I got so many different views of Magic and of ways to play the game and of different ways people live from around the country as I was growing up playing Magic. And it's all just such a big part of what makes me now.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's cool. I was going to ask so kind of being in one spot for most of your Magic career, how have you seen the Magic scene develop around you?
The Magic scene in Mississippi is interesting. I have a friend, his name is John Clock, and he's, I think of him kind of as the father of Southern Mississippi Magic. He lives up in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, which is about an hour north of me. And he's been playing the game since the beginning, and he's always fostered this tournament scene in the area. And he likes to say that Mississippi is the land that Magic forgot. Because I think you said it yourself before the cast, that you've never had anyone from Mississippi on. And it's just kind of true. You know, not a lot of Magic is played in Mississippi. Not a lot of Magic is played in the South outside of the big major hubs. And it's just kind of part of the whole thing is feeling like you're always going to be the underdog because you're from these areas. And everyone has that kind of drive to them. Every single person down here wants to make a name for themselves and be that person who is the first from Mississippi to make a big scene. And I think I'm in a pretty competitive area for people that really want to make it. Mm-hmm. And it's really nice.
So what would you say to someone who may be in an area like yours, whether it's, you know, some other place here in the States or some, you know, some other rural-ish or area in the world, because we have listeners all over the place. Someone in a similar situation, similar locale as you, what would you say to them as far as words of encouragement goes?
It's hard. It is. But you need to find those people that are near you that have that same drive, and you need to really, really work together. It doesn't always have to be a lot of people, just a couple. But if you all have that drive together and you're able to make it work, you can drive to far places, find the events you want to play at, and really work together to make something special out of what you have, because you have so much less than other people to start with. And ultimately, I think it almost works to your benefit in a way if you're able to make it work, because you become so much more invested because you know it's so much harder for you.
Cool. So what resources have you used to keep your finger on the pulse of Magic, to, you know, assist you in this journey from, you know, to making it to top finishes?
Well, I've always been, you know, once I hit the age of understanding, you know, there's a point where there goes from just kind of playing Magic because I was, you know, little and didn't fully understand, to actually understanding how Magic worked and what I was doing. Mm-hmm. Where, yeah, I was about 13. I started reading articles. I started playing Magic online. And those are the things that, you know, everyone does have access to. You know, you may not have the things around you, but you always have access to all those articles. And there's a lot of great players writing great things. And you have this ability to play Magic at any time of day. And, you know, you can put in lots and lots of hours of work and learn a lot at the tips of your fingers. And that's what I do pretty constantly.
Cool. Man, that's great. Now, when did you start becoming more competitive in Magic? Tell us about that transition, you know, from most likely playing casually as a 5-year-old and whatnot to becoming more serious and you probably going to local events and stuff like that. When was that transition, and tell us about that?
Well, I think I went to my first PTQ when I was 7. Obviously I wasn't set up to do very well, but part of that was, as I said, my dad played, and my dad liked to play competitively. He's always been a competitive person, and a lot of that, you know, I got a lot of that. So he would kind of take me to these places and we'd play things. So I got around that scene pretty early on. I didn't do very well for myself, obviously, when I was younger, but I think I got my first PTQ top 8 during Scars of Mirrodin. So it took a long time, you know, from when I started traveling to those to when it happened. But it's definitely, I like to think that was about the time I finally started wanting to do something competitive in the game. And that was about the time, you know, once I first got access to the internet and got to see the huge world that is Magic and all the things that were possible, I wanted to be part of that because it was a thing that gave me so much joy already. Why not make it even more?
That's cool. So when you started getting competitive, what was a challenge that you faced, that you struggled with, but that you eventually overcame?
So there's the struggles of location, and there's the struggles of being young. You know, I had the issue of it. I couldn't always travel with people because if I didn't go with my dad or my brother, they wouldn't always let me go because I was so young. And that was an interesting thing. Definitely one of the struggles I had when I was in that time was, you know, card availability. I didn't have a lot of money. I was even younger than the 16-year-olds that were playing the game, and my dad and I didn't put a lot into it. So I had to brew with what I had, and I would find strange cards to make good, and I did my best to try and figure out other ways to attack the game because of restrictions. And I think that's, you know, I think that's a famous, like, Mark Rosewater thing, is restrictions breed creativity.
Heck yeah.
And that was definitely a big part of what I had to do.
That's great. So just taking what you had and making it work, being creative, finding, you know, ways to maximize those cards. That's really neat. So card availability. I guess what was one of the biggest things that helped you get past the card availability issue?
Well, it goes back to networking and finding friends and it being able to make those groups that really care about helping each other out. You know, Magic is it's a communal game. And if you're not doing it with people you enjoy with, or if you can't find someone who really loves it the same way you do, sometimes things kind of fall flat. So I found those people and I was able to borrow cards and I started to, you know, play with better cards and I could see why those cards were better and how to make those better cards work with those weird things I was doing before. And I made these conglomerations that actually ended up winning instead of just doing okay. It was the shift that I think really pushed me towards the stages of starting to be good at the game.
Sweet. That's really cool. So as you went on your journey, and we'll kind of build up to your recent top finish and dive into that more, you had ups and downs along the way, like every Magic player does. We all do. What would you say was your worst Magic moment?
Oh, my. There's normally a really long story that goes with this. So I think it's a really interesting one. But, of course, this is not the best format for that. But my first ever SCG Open was the Open in Birmingham, Alabama. And I ended up 0-2-ing the Open, the Standard Open. I didn't have a Legacy deck. This is back in the days of two-day opens. So they had draft opens. So I did a draft open, and I had the best blue-black deck I had ever had in Innistrad Limited. I had Bloodline Keeper, Curse of Death's Hold. I had, like, two other rares that were good. My curve was absurd. I easily won my first two matches, and in my third match I lost to someone who didn't seem to really know what they were doing super well. I lost to getting milled out by Cellar Door plus Trepanation Blade. So that was a pretty unfortunate match. And immediately after, they had another draft open, so I joined that one. And I ended up getting DQ'd for peeking during the draft that I was not doing. This was during Innistrad, and I had a pretty aggressive Red-Green Werewolves deck, and I was looking around to see what cards, flip cards, people had taken, and there was a miscommunication. I was young at the time. I didn't know how to discuss with a judge about what I was trying to do, and I was just overwhelmed when a judge was talking to me, and I ended up, you know, having that happen. And that was my first time I had ever really traveled and stayed overnight to play at a big event, and I did horrible. And I was accused of cheating when I wasn't, and I was just miserable the whole time. And that was definitely that was the start of my traveling. And it was pretty rough.
Well, I mean,
to say the least.
Good for you for sticking with it. Yeah, but that was your first time traveling and having that experience. So, wow. So a lot of factors go into that, but what did you take away from that? So looking back on it, you know, obviously a lot of distance helps. What did you learn and what can you share with us that we can take away from your experience?
One of the things I definitely learned was that in the Standard Open, I had decided to play a brew that was pretty heavily untested, and that wasn't very wise. You know, if you're going to take the time to travel to these big events, you should make sure you put in your effort beforehand to make sure what you're doing is actually good. And you shouldn't just kind of roll the dice and hope your deck is all based on theoreticals. Because that's not going to work every time. It's not going to work most of the time. And it certainly didn't for me there. I also learned, you know, kind of the hard way about the darker, rougher side of Magic when it comes to, you know, learning how to talk to judges. Because that's a thing that a lot of players that don't get to travel much have a real issue with. And it sucks that that's part of the game, because it shouldn't be. And it sucks that you have to be kind of weary about what you're saying, even though it's a game and you're trying to have fun. but I learned that you have to be confident in yourself, and you have to be confident in what you're saying when you're speaking to judges. And because if you have confidence, then oftentimes you can make sure they understand where you're coming from. And oftentimes you can make a compromise that is much more workable for both of you, which is definitely a stepping stone that's really hard for people that don't play competitively to get to.
How does one even practice that? Like, how do you get comfortable with, you know, being in those situations and presenting yourself eloquently to a judge?
I think it's one of those things that it's really hard to just practice for. It just comes with the realization that most judges are not there to hurt you. Mm-hmm. They are there to help the tournament run correctly and to make sure everyone has a fair chance. And when you come to the realization that they are not your enemy and that you are supposed to work with them, it is often much easier to find that common ground, because no judge wants to DQ players, or no judge wants to give game losses or anything. You know, no judge is happy when they're sorting through deck lists and they see you misregistered something. Because they always know someone's going to be sad in the end, and that is not what you're trying to do. So I think a lot of it is just knowing what the common ground is and realizing that and using that to your advantage.
Cool. Thank you for sharing that. On the flip side are our highs. So what has been your proudest Magic moment to date?
My proudest Magic moment was definitely the SCG Open in Dallas. I guess it was 2015 or 2014 now. I don't remember exactly. But it was a double SCG standard weekend. And before the event, we had a car of four people. It was me, my sister, who also plays. I didn't get to say that earlier. And two of the people from our local store. Well, both of them bailed out. So it was just me and my sister, but we had already booked the hotel room. And we decided to go anyway. So we drove 10 hours to Dallas.
Nice.
And this is the time where I didn't know what deck I was playing. I didn't really have a great handle of the standard format at the time, but I realized that I wanted to be attacking. I realized I liked the card Gorokrine Rampager. This was Ravnica Innistrad Standard right after Dragon's Maze was released. So we had the whole block. So I kind of just in the car threw together this Naya Aggro deck. I had been working on similar builds before. I started with the mono red deck and started playing a little more green, and then realized I wanted bigger creatures, so I added white to play Loxodon on Smiters, and by the end of it, I shifted away from the red and became more of this green-white aggro deck, just splashing red. And I kind of put it all together, and I was playing some kind of weird card choices in the end, but I played it in the open, and I ended up top eating. This was my first open top eight. And I did it with a deck of my own design that I thought was really cool. And I ended up losing in the top eight of the open, but it was a double standard weekend. So I came back the next day. I didn't change anything in my deck, even though I probably should have, but I was just so tired from the day before. I played the same deck and I went undefeated in the Swiss and made it into the top eight and went undefeated in the top eight and ended up winning the tournament with this deck that did not exist before. And I was really, really proud. I was a 16-year-old kid and I had figured out something that, you know, players that had played the game far more than me and far better than me hadn't figured out yet. And to me, that is like the driving force in Magic, is to find that something special that no one else has.
That is really cool. Putting together a deck of your own design and then obviously doing so well with it, I can definitely see how that would be, you know, a highlight of your Magic career. That's really cool.
Yeah, I think that's kind of like the theme of my career almost, is finding these weird cards and these weird things and making them function. Because that's what I enjoy doing. That is my part of Magic that I really like.
So what did that do for you, that event, that win? I'm assuming that was some kind of a springboard, or maybe it wasn't, but tell us, what did that lead to for you?
No, it definitely was a springboard. You know, I had a lot of factors going right for me. I was young, I had an interesting deck, and I top-eated both days. You know, that's a lot of factors that can lead to people noticing me. And there a lot of people that I really looked up to, you know, messaged me and asked me questions. And it's like, you know, why did you play this card? Do you feel like this might be better? Yada, yada, yada. And I got to meet some people that way and, you know, communicated, and I networked from that. And that's a big part of getting into competitive Magic is networking and meeting those people that are better than you. Because when you play with people who are better than you, you will get better.
Yeah.
You'll see what they are doing and you will learn from them. And that was definitely the stepping stone for me to doing better and better over time.
Cool. So bringing things up to recently, at least, what has been your most recent top finish?
My most recent top finish was Grand Prix Memphis. I made it to the finals playing Sultai Constrictor, another deck that was largely of my own design, and played some weird cards, and I did really well with them. And it was my first great finish on the on the Grand Prix Pro Tour circuit, instead of the SCG one. It feels really good. I've always gotten really close to top eight in Grand Prix, a lot of 12 and threes, and it feels really good to finally break through that barrier to make it into the top eight.
What do you think was the difference? Like, what did it take to get you finally into the top eight?
Effort.
Okay.
Time.
Yeah.
I tested a lot for Grand Prix Memphis, more than I had for any event before it. It's not even close. Going into the Grand Prix, I started really testing, a month out, standarded, kind of figured out, a lot of people figured out what the good decks were. Things like Grixis Energy were good, and the blue-black decks were good. And I messed around with a couple shells. I was trying to make Merfolk work, and I was in the Merfolk deck. I was a big fan of Hadana's Climb, and I went from Hadana's Climb to maybe Snakes, and started messing with that deck and built some lists. And I do stream Magic, so for 2 weeks leading up to the event, I streamed this Sultai deck, and I switched cards and I moved things around. And I would play two or three leagues, 5 days a week. So by the time I got to the Grand Prix, I had played, 60, 70 matches with this deck against varying things, which is more time than I had really put into a lot of decks. I guess it was even more than that, really, 150 matches closer. Hmm. And that was just a lot. It was a lot. I learned a lot. I learned how to play against each deck. I learned cards that I thought were good in the short term, but after playing with them a long time, I realized that they weren't exactly what I wanted to be doing, because cards can be tricky like that. You can play them in a couple of matches and they feel really good, but then you just kind of realize they aren't really pulling their weight after a long string of time. And to me, that was the difference. Hmm. I finally overcame the barrier of just kind of theory crafting decks and not testing as much as I should have, to really putting in the effort necessary.
So how did you decide on the Sultai deck? You're just like, this sounds cool. And then as you started testing it more and more and more and more and seeing that it worked, you decided to go with that? Or I guess, when did you decide that, I'm going to run this deck? And that it's a good choice,
Right. I do play a lot of decks. I'll run leagues with just different brews that come into my mind often, and most of them are pretty bad. So when I do play one and I 4-1 or something, I keep it.
Okay.
I save the deck and I decide, maybe this is doing something right. And you can really feel what you're doing right a lot of the time with decks. The first time I cast Winding Constrictor into Hadana's Climb and I attacked my opponent for 4, I felt like I was doing something powerful. And in a format like Standard, that's a lot of the times that's what you're looking for if you're looking for an aggressive deck, because you really want something powerful that plays at a different angle than the other decks. And Climb is a card that really got to do that. I remember theory crafting this type of deck with some friends right when Hadana's Climb was spoiled. Last season, there was a Sultai Skies deck that did reasonably well at a couple Grand Prix. I don't think it ever top eighted, but it had some 12 and 3 finishes. And it was just a green-black constrictor deck, and it splashed blue for Cartouche Knowledge. Because Cartouche Knowledge on Bristling Hydra was such a powerful combination. And I realized that the energy package is way weaker now with the loss of a 2-inch Ether and Rogue Refiner, so you can't lean on that as much. But Hadana's Climb, after playing with the card just a couple times, I realized it was so powerful that it could make up for that, and that you can craft your deck around trying to make that card as good as possible, because it's just so much power packed in a single card. And that is the type of things you're generally looking to brew your decks around.
Man, that's so neat that you went through that process and that you were conscious enough to make those observations and make those changes. And I absolutely love that. That's really cool. So you decided on this deck, you practiced a lot with it, really got some good observations. What were some of the things that you were looking for? You mentioned kind of realizing over time cards that were underperforming, but what are some other insights you could share about that process of what are you looking for? What are you identifying in a deck that makes it good that make it good or not good as we're going through that process trying to refine our decks?
So I definitely consider myself more of an aggressive expert than other archetypes. And that's definitely where my field of knowledge is going to come in. So one of the things I love is tricks. Mm-hmm. I love pump spells. I love things that mess with combat, that mess with spells, you know, your God's Willings, your Giant Growths, and you have Blossoming Defense. And that card is everything I'd ever wanted in a Magic card. Matthias Hunt likes to joke that it's my invitational card. It is the type of card that I adore playing with, because there's always a point in the game where the card's going to be good, and it's very good if your opponent doesn't. If your opponent is not as good, it is the type of card that is great because your opponent's not going to play around it. And if your opponent is very good, it's still the type of card that might be able to get them because they are playing around it so aggressively sometimes that you gain an edge that way because they can play so scared of this trick. Now, saying that, I have 4 copies of that card in my deck for a long time. Mm-hmm. But there's this point when you have to realize that too much of a good thing can be bad for you, especially in anything aggressive, because you're so focused on making sure you curve out and you're so focused on making sure you don't run out of threats that if your deck is running a lot of copies of cards like Blossoming Defense and Hadana's Climb, your decks can have a real issue of having a lot of non-games. And that was, I think, one of the biggest changes from the first list to the final list. Is the first list like maxed out on Blossoming Defenses, played 3 climbs or 2 climbs, and played Cartouchonologist still and the removal spells. And I had a lot of non-creatures in my deck.
Yeah.
And we're at the point in card design in Magic where oftentimes creatures are more powerful than spells at the same mana cost. And that's just kind of going to be, that's just the new design philosophy, I guess. So if you look at your aggressive deck and you feel like you're playing a lot of non-games, or you feel like you're getting flooded or blown out, oftentimes it's not that you flooded, it's that you got spell flooded because you draw these cool interactive things. But if you had just actually drawn a grizzly bear, you might have attacked your opponent and they might have just died. So I think that's one of the biggest takeaways from that deck and from my testing with that deck in particular over time, is you have to be really weary about making sure you have the right balance in your deck.
Cool, man. Good stuff. And as you have played a ton of Magic and all different parts of the world and against so many different people, what is the biggest mistake that you have seen players make?
The fear of losing is something that holds back many, many players. And I get to see it from the other side. And this goes back to the Blossoming Defense comment about people playing around it too hard. My favorite decks are aggressive decks. My deck I play in Modern is Infect. And that is a deck that puts fear into people. The second you cast a Glistener Elf on turn 1, you see the look on your opponent's face. And they say, I didn't sign up to play this game. Mm-hmm. Because people, when there's this fear of losing and the fear of being outplayed, will often make you play worse, ultimately, because you're worried about doing something stupid, and you're so worried that you can't see the forest through the trees. You know, you can't figure out what's actually going on. And I've won a lot of matches that way. If you're people, you know, either choosing to respect things far too much, or just kind of breaking down in tough situations when there's so many things they need to play around and they have to figure out what they can play around and what they can't. And they oftentimes will overestimate what they can play around and end up losing the game in ways and giving me time in ways that they didn't mean to.
How do we get over that? What are your suggestions on not letting the fear of losing control how we play?
Ultimately, it boils down to you have to, this is kind of counterintuitive, but you have to not be so invested sometimes. You know, you need to not take your losses as personal offenses. And you have to respect that you might lose the game to a certain card sometimes. And you have to respect that, you know, I might lose if they have this Waspring Defense, but I can't beat it if they have it. Mm-hmm. So you just play like they don't. And if they have it, you know, you say, sure, I made the correct decision. And you have to tell yourself, even if you lost the game because you didn't play around it, or that you made the correct decision by not doing so.
Right.
And that's really hard because you know you had the choice to play around it. And you had the choice to make different decisions. But the one you make, even though you lost, was the correct one. And if you're confident it was the correct one, you have to be okay with losing.
Very good. Now, what aspects of Magic have you been able to apply to other areas of your life? What have you learned from the game that you've taken elsewhere?
Well, as I said, you know, I learned a lot about just thinking through Magic, and that helped a lot in school. I was always a really good student, had good, you know, I got good test taking procedures through Magic, because when you're under stress playing card games, a lot of that translates to just being under stress taking a test. Outside of school, I really gained a lot of, you know, social traits through Magic. You grow up and you see what things like and what conversation, you know, how to speak in a conversation that is good for everyone around you. And you can use those things. And I think that's probably the most important trait is I like to think I'm pretty personable and that a lot of people like to talk to me. And that is the most powerful trait I've gotten. And because as I go back to, I think one of the most important things in Magic is networking and being able to talk to people. And that's just, you know, one of the most important aspects in life is being able to talk to people. Because if you know a lot of people, oftentimes you're able to help each other and just for mutual benefit throughout your life.
And what does being a good sport mean to you, Aaron?
So being a good sport, I think, is possibly one of the most complicated topics in Magic. Yeah, everyone has their own opinion. Ultimately, being a good sport is the idea that at the end of the day, you want everyone that you played with and yourself to have enjoyed your games, to have enjoyed what you were doing, to have enjoyed the time you spent. And I think that's just kind of the baseline rule. If you're doing something and it makes one of you miserable, it's probably something wrong. It's probably not good sportsmanship most of the time. Of course, there is outliers to every rule, but you know, sportsmanship boils down to the idea that it is a game, that we're here to have fun, and that no one's robots. No one is there to make anybody miserable, I hope. Mm-hmm. And that my goal as a player and as a good sportsman is to make everyone have to leave a lasting impression that is good and to make sure everyone enjoyed themselves. And if I'm doing that, it doesn't matter how bad I did in the tournament. It was a good day.
I like that. That's really succinct. You know, each of your opponents and you should have enjoyed the interaction and the experience of playing together. I think that's really, really cool. That's really cool. Man, I love it. So here you are. You top aided a Grand Prix this season. How many pro points do you have?
I have 14. I have a couple like X4 finishes, and I did play at Pro Tour Ixalan. So if you include the 3 pro points from Pro Tour Dominaria I'm going to have 17. So I need 3 more for silver.
Nice.
Which I would be real unfortunate if I didn't get that because I am flying up to Grand Prix Seattle. I'm going to be playing that. And I have a couple other things possibly on my planning list. But I definitely feel like I've been to the Pro Tour twice now, and I feel like I'm slowly getting a handle on it. So I've slowly done better. My last Pro Tour, I went, I started 8-8, then I went 9-7. You know, I want to do better than 10-6 this time, but I've always day two, and I always feel like I'm starting to get it a little bit. I had a lot of help from my good friend Donald Smith, who I know has been on your show before.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
He and I went to our first Pro Tour together at Battle for Zendikar. And, you know, he re-queued and chained queues, and I fell off. And we tested together, and we figured a lot of stuff out together, and we always tried to help each other out. And I actually think he's one of my biggest supporters now, and it's really cool to see him achieve so much, and that's a lot for me.
Yeah.
So part of that drive is going to make me want to do what he did, you know, go from zero to hero really fast.
So
that's kind of the dream.
How have you been to a couple of Pro Tours, but this was your first Grand Prix Top 8?
The RPTQ system
cool. Has
been pretty good to me.
Cool.
It's kind of funny in that I think I'm in a bad area for the RPTQ system because there's not a lot of stores. But I was able to win most of them, and I've been to nearly every RPTQ. I've had many, many near finishes, but I did qualify for Battle for Zendikar through that, and I qualified for Ixalan through that.
Very cool.
I did it in the harder way almost than top 8 in Grand Prix.
Yeah, I guess there's an argument for which one's harder, right? So that's cool. Well, that's neat. That's awesome. Like, we love hearing, you know, where the guest stands and what they have going on. Effectively 17 points. It's really good. Then making a run for silver this season. That's great. Like, we love seeing past guests do great things. So we wish you the best of luck in that endeavor for sure. So that's cool. Now, as we kind of around the corner and head on to the end, I do want to remind the Prodigies, if you want to connect with Aaron, the best place to do that is on Twitter, or at least you can find him there, at RuneClaw_Barich. And Aaron, what is a parting piece of guidance that you have for us? Either something that you already said that you want to emphasize, or something new you want to leave with us here at the end?
I guess the best piece of advice ultimately is have fun. If you're not having fun in Magic, if you're not enjoying the games you're playing, if you're not enjoying even your testing, then you're not going to do well in Magic or in life if you're not having fun, ultimately. I think it's that simple.
Well, Aaron, I want to acknowledge you for your contributions to the multiverse, and thank you so much for your time and for sharing your experiences and your stories with us today. You are a hero among planeswalkers, and it's been a blast chatting with you. May you never be mana screwed, always draw what you need, and depart every plane victorious.
Thank you so much. It was fun to be here.
Aaron, thank you so much for coming on to the show. Prodigies, of course, you can get the show notes at mtgpro2.com/AaronBarich. And before we close out, I want to say thank you again to Paragon City Games for their support of the show, being a proud sponsor. Check them out at ParagonCityGames.com. And, of course, the patrons. I want to give a huge shout-out to our newest patrons, Brooke Papal and Andreas Bickert. Thank you so much for supporting the show at the Bed of Plants level, no less. So your names will be considered in all future drawings for the patron-exclusive giveaway that we do. And I'll be announcing last month's winner in next week's episode, so stay tuned to see who won. And again, best of luck to everybody who's going out to the 2 Grand Prix this weekend in Seattle. Wish I could be there. Almost was. But alas, duty calls. Remember, as you play, to treat every player with respect. They want to win just as much as you do. They deserve to be treated just as well as you would want to be treated yourself, right? So that's what we've been exploring a bit more here on the show: sportsmanship, dedication, and respect. 3 values that all of us as prodigies should hold near and dear to our hearts. So best of luck out there playing Magic, whether it's at the Grand Prix, Friday Night Magic, or at the kitchen table. Thanks so much for tuning in. I can't wait till next week when we connect again. Until then, I'm Sean of The Gathering, and we will see you in the next cast.
This round of MTG Pro Tutor is over. So you don't miss a single episode of MTG Mastery, be sure to subscribe to the show on your preferred podcast listening service for more exclusive interviews, deck building tips, and elite content. Or visit mtgprotutor.com to stream it straight from the source. We look forward to helping you think and play like a pro.